The distant future.
It is the distant future, the year 2000.
We are robots.
The world is very different ever since the robotic uprising of the mid-90s. There is no more unhappiness.
Affirmative.
We no longer say yes. Instead, we say affirmative.
Yes, affirmative.
Unless it's a more colloquial situation with a few robo-friends. There is only one kind of dance, the robot.
And the robo-boogie.
Oh yes, two kinds of dances.
Finally, robotic beings rule the world.
Hello and welcome to the 14th edition of Chaos Radio Express, the international version. So we are speaking English here, which is good. I don't know when I did the last post in this channel. It's probably a year ago. Yeah, lots of things have happened, so there are many reasons why we haven't been able to produce anything new here. But this is now the past, and the current situation is back at the microphone trying to bring interesting interviews and interesting topics to the world. So hello again, my name is Tim Pritlove. I'm member of the Chaos Computer Club, and Chaos Radio Express is a podcast channel of the CCC. You can check out other things by the CCC at our podcast network website, chaosradio.ccc.de. So, but I'm not alone. As I said, this is basically an interview podcast, so I can say hello to Bree Pettis. Hello.
Hello, Tim. It's good to be here.
Yes. We are in Berlin right now. It's December 2007, and we are...
In the podcast lair of Tim Pritlove.
Yeah, which is, yeah, my desk.
Wires everywhere. Headphones hanging from the shelves and ceilings.
Any other interesting things to report?
I mean, bins of gear. There's wires and interfaces and tapes everywhere.
It's a small hackerspace. Yes. So, but there's a reason why you are here as well.
Yes.
You are visiting Berlin. You are here for a month.
Yep.
How is it going so far?
Oh, it's going great. Well, it's been a little bit of a journey. I started off in Austria for a month. I got invited to be an artist in residence with Monochrome and went there and just had a blast with the folks from Monochrome and GRL Vienna and the Mita Lab. And many awesome hacking sessions were had through the night with many leaders of Club Mate. And then we've got the Chaos Communication Congress coming up, 24C3, at the end of the year. And I thought, well, I could go home and then come back, or I could just go to Berlin for a month. And I hung on that decision for about 1 millisecond. And then I was like, okay, I'll go and live in Berlin for a month. This will be great. Because, I was here a little bit this summer, and it was fantastic. So I'm back and staying with Elliot here in Prenzlauer.
Who's doing the Hackaday weblog.
Yep, exactly. And so we're very happily, in a little apartment, and we can walk outside and see babies everywhere.
Yeah, this is baby land. Yeah. It's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've been here in the summer, which means you have been visiting our other event,
yep,
the Chaos Communication Camp. How has that been for you?
That was really inspiring. I mean, I was on the Hackers on a Plane tour, where I started off going to DEF CON and then flew on a plane and then took a bus to camp and got there and again didn't sleep very much and met lots of interesting people and saw
we should explain
projects.
This Hackers on the Plane thing, we should give a stop on. So this was, how many people were actually participating? I forgot.
I think 35 or 40 people came on the plane. We got on the plane. So everybody went to DEF CON, and I actually didn't know very many people at DEF CON, and then we all gathered at the end of DEF CON.
DEF CON in Las Vegas.
That's right, and which is a big hacker conference in the States. And then we got on one single plane, and a young hacker had somehow managed to bring a giant 12-volt battery, or maybe it was like 20 or 25D batteries all hooked together. And we had he was able to keep his computer running the whole time, and we had a...
In the plane.
Yeah, so we had an IRC channel throughout the whole plane that anybody could join. And
there was, I guess there was a 100% computer coverage on that flight.
And, we were hackers on a plane, so of course Dan Kaminsky brings a bunch of... Somehow he managed to get a ton of rubber snakes onto the plane. And the first... So the first thing that happens is somebody grabs them from Dan and throws them all in the face of one of the stewardesses, and she screams. And every time she walked past us through the whole flight, her eyes kind of got a little squinty. And
oh my God,
it was great. And then we arrived to camp. Yeah, and camp, if you don't know much about it, it's fantastic. It's done every 4 years, run by the Chaos Computer Club. And they bring a bunch of bandwidth and a bunch of infrastructure together for a conference where people come and talk about the most interesting things in the world. And it's kind of, and then there's all sorts of art and magic and beauty and lots of action happening. And, you know, you basically 24/7 for, I think it was like a week.
4 or 5 days, yeah. Right? Yeah, officially it's 5 days. There's a core of 4 days, yeah, with conference program. Yeah, right. This time it was very international. I mean, the camp was the third time the camp happened. It's always every 4 years. But we always try to, you know, have an international focus with the camp, even more than we had with our annual congress, which has changed recently. But back then, 1999, was the first true international event we have been planning. And since then, more and more people are coming from everywhere in Europe. And this time, it was really getting to a point where I said, like, oops, that's not at all a German event anymore. It's a truly, at least, European event.
It had the greatest flavor, though. I remember arriving, and it was just getting dark, and it got dark. And then I went out walking around, and there's MiG jets everywhere, lit from the inside with different color LEDs, and there's spotlights. It was definitely like some sort of, you know, it was like some sort of imaginary techno rave of the Cold War or something like that. I don't know. It was really it was magic.
Yeah, it's the space we had with the airport museum, yeah, where they have gathered all military planes and helicopters and rocket launchers and whatnot. Yeah, all in these hangars. Yeah, it was a very amazing view, and the site was beautiful. So what did you do at the camp?
It's all a blur, honestly. I just met people, got inspired, and that's all I remember. I remember more visual, just seeing everything and meeting all sorts of interesting people, having great conversations. I would say, like, I didn't really process what was going on at the time. It took me like months to actually like be like, oh yeah, because then what happened after the camp was also equally inspiring. We went from camp, and none of us had slept at all, and we were all totally excited about everything because everything was exciting and connections were made everywhere. And then we drove around Germany and Austria visiting hackerspaces.
Mm-hmm.
So we went...
Where have you been?
So we went went to a party at... Well, so the places I've been, we went to C-Base right away.
In Berlin right now.
And everybody was really tired from camp. So like 6 people were asleep. People were getting Sharpies drawn on their face. It was trouble. And if you haven't been to C-Base or know about it, C-Base is a space station that is embedded in Berlin. Many, many eons ago, a space station crashed Earth, and it's been unearthed by these hackers who are working to reverse engineer it to send it back up into space so it can return in the future. So it also functions as the upper level is a club with awesome music and really fantastic sound system. And then downstairs is a hacker lair where all sorts of interesting things happen.
Right. So, and from there you went on to see other hackerspaces that have
evolved. Yeah, we drove all through the night to meet a lab, and I broke my glasses on that trip. And arrived at MetaLab the next day, and you know, it's a real
MetaLab is in Vienna.
Yes. And so a little bit about that. That's it. The MetaLab is a hackerspace in Vienna where it's you can go there. It's very open atmosphere, and there's a there's one main room where people open up computers and hack on stuff, and a library and a kitchen, and there's a smoking slash Dance Dance Revolution game room where they've embedded solid steel DDR game controllers into the floor so that everybody can, all the hackers can get some exercise. And then they've got an electronics lab, and really great minds gather there to play with fun stuff.
Yeah, it's a great place. I just recently did a German podcast on MetaLab. It's now here for 1.5 years and has been doing very well since its inception. It's really a focus point for all kind of people interested in technology, doing things that just need space and a place to meet. So that was sort of the a concept you were sort of researching while being here.
Well, I didn't even know that that was, like, I just basically signed up and they said, do you want to come on this hacker tour of Europe? And I was like, give me the full meal deal. Whatever you've got going on, I'll do it. Yes, yes, yes. And I didn't know what I was in for. I was like, my eyes were opened all over the place. Because then from Vienna, we went off to Cologne, where there's three hacker spaces within about an hour of each other. There's C4, which is the Chaos Computer Club Cologne. And they were really nice to us. We arrived and they made a huge vegetarian dinner in their hacker space for us that was like, it was so tasty. And yeah, Lars is really a good cook there. And then a bunch of people slept there, and some of us slept at a hotel down the street. And yeah, we'd hung out there, and that was kind of our, we'd wake up every morning and then, or every afternoon, and then we'd go off and see things. And we went off to see Das Labor, which is in Bochum. Bochum.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a really cool little hacker space. Well, first, before I go on to Bochum, C4 is a place that's similar to other hacker spaces, and it's kind of, it's not as big as some, but it's definitely got every single like thing you need. It's got a shower, it's got a smoking room, it's got a couple different rooms so people can branch off and meet. It's got a presentation space with a projector, and it's got, you know, all these places are very well stocked with Club Mate. This is a key ingredient to every hackerspace, actually.
Absolutely, absolutely.
One of the things that the folks at C4 also did besides cooking for us was they presented us with this really amazing presentation. It's in PDF on the internet. It's a hackerspace. It's design patterns for hackerspaces, where they were originally thinking, like, we'll make up a little book that they can, that will teach people how to make a hackerspace. And they realized, no, it's not a book. It's design patterns. And it's a beautiful thing. It's really a pure, wonderful, it's a purely wonderful document that goes through and explains what's worked for them. Not what might work for you, but it's what's worked for them consistently over many, many years of hackerspaces in Germany.
Yeah, that's really an interesting paper. I've already taken a look at it, and I found lots of things that I have also encountered during I mean Chaos Computer Club here in Berlin, and we have this space for a very long time as well, and it definitely applies to that as well. We're going to have this talk, this presentation also at the 24th Chaos Communication Congress, the upcoming congress at the end of the year.
Yes.
Which is happening, and we have to say this here, every year, always at the same date, which is the 27th to the 30th of December. So it's stuck right in the middle between Christmas and New Year's Eve, which some people would consider a totally ridiculous date. Which
I consider it the best date in the complete world.
As I told you before, there's just two groups of people on the planet. One is considering it to be the best, the other to be the worst date possible. But it's just the way it is, and it's not keeping more than 4,000 people away from it. So it's a big party. So
they're on the first day.
So this presentation
at 2 p.m.
Sorry?
There's that presentation.
Yeah.
Day one, building a hackerspace, 2 p.m. 27.
Okay, book your plane now.
yeah.
Can you recommend coming over to it? Well, you haven't seen the Congress yet.
I've never been to the Congress, but I mean, right now, I still have to get back to my journey, but we'll take. Well, I have to say, like, oh, well, so C4, one of the things that they're bringing to, besides the hackerspace design patterns, they were like, yeah, let's see if we can make. Okay, so here's, let me tell you what their presentation is says here. It says, steam-powered telegraphy, wherein a league of tele-extraordinary gentlemen present the marvel of telex on the global internet, driven by a steam engine. Okay, people, it's a teletype working as an RSS reader powered by steam. Like, if you don't come for anything, that's a reason to travel, you know, more than halfway around the world to get here.
They're excited. That's good. So
I heard a little story that they were all sitting around and they were like, this would be really cool if it was powered by steam. And they were like frantically looking for a steam engine. And some kid in the background basically said, well, I just started engineering school and I don't think it'd be that hard to just make one. And then they did.
That's good.
Yeah. It makes me happy. I can't wait to see that.
So,
right.
That's your topic. Your laptop says, I make things. But before I want to go into that and your personal background, maybe we should just
I have to finish up the story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So you've been in Cologne. You have that presentation. You had a great meal.
And then we went off to Das Labor.
Right.
And if you don't know about Das Labor, it's another part of the, I believe they're connected to the CCC.
They are somehow connected. It's not one of these official
right.
spaces, but it's definitely part of our larger audience.
Yeah. And that started a little bit differently. They got started because there was this space and it was a like a bunch of nonprofits were going to take over a building and there was a space left over. And the people who were organizing it went to a few people and said, what could you do with this space? And they were like, it would be cool to have a hackerspace there. And so literally overnight, they just made something up and it got approved. And all of a sudden they had a space and they had something to do with it. They had to do something with it. So it's a really young crowd. And there's a few guys there who are insanely into hardware hacking. And so they're really into the quadcopters. And they've really taken this idea of like, they call them Borg cubes. So they're LED cubes. So they're like 8x8x8 LED cubes and they've figured out ways to program in 3D and it's insanely inspiring. I cannot wait to see them again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're going to Congress. Present their stuff at the Congress, right?
Yes. And then we went to Netzladen, which is a hackerspace that's shared with an anarchist political group. So that's two great tastes that go great together. And it's more of a infrastructure space for people to meet rather than like a hacker lair. But
which is probably not a big difference. I mean, that's what these hacker spaces are about, just to have a defined place with internet and other facilities where you can just drop in, meet people, and do whatever you think is appropriate to do.
So strangely enough, so we're in Cologne and I realized that two of the other people at this point, I'd been talking to all these people for a while and we're like, wait a second. There's a couple. You're from New York too. There were three of us who were from New York City, and we're like, okay, there's three of us, and we're seeing all these hacker spaces. We should really just do this. And in about 4 hours, we'd come up with a name, start up the website, put the wiki up. While we were in Cologne, got the mailing list set up, got all the infrastructure going, started getting people interested, and by the time we were back after a few months, people were interested, and we've actually got a group now. It's called NYC Resistor, and it's a group of, it's officially 7 kind of core members with a bunch of other people who are serious enthusiasts. And then a bunch every month we have 1 or 2 meetings where it's like show and tell and people bring their insanely cool projects and share them. And in the new year, we're going to be starting up giving classes so that we can raise money. And
so there is a space as well.
We don't have a space. We've been using the Lemurplex has been kind enough to let us meet there. The Lemurplex is the League of Electronic Music Urban Robots. Mm-hmm. And that's Eric Singer's awesome project where he makes musical robots that he then has composers write for. And he's got a space that he lets us meet there. We've kind of outgrown it at this point because we keep having more and more people come. So
But eventually you might.
We're going to find.
Look for
we need our own space. It's really clear. We need our own workshop and space, and that's where we're going.
Is that easy to find in New York?
No. It's going to be. I'm not going to say it's going to be expensive because I'm hoping that it won't be. But we're currently, when I get back, we start the affiliate. We just became an LLC so that we can actually have a bank account that people can put money into and so that we can, as a group, do things like rent a space. Mm-hmm. And so the next step is really fundraising and finding a space and making it happen.
Where would you look for in New York for a space, which is like the part of the city that would be most attractive to?
I would be most happy if it was in Manhattan somewhere. I would love to have a storefront with a basement for storage where we could have sort of a gallery meeting atmosphere. So we could, you know, and then in the basement have a workshop and storage.
Okay, good luck.
That would be the best.
Yeah.
If we can't find that, we could go to Brooklyn or one of the burbs, and there's a lot of interesting things happen there. So that wouldn't be bad, but
it's
ideally
a big city. It should be possible to find something appropriate. So, so we're slowly coming to the point why I have invited you for a talk. Mm-hmm. As I said before, your laptop says I make things. Is this engraved?
It's laser etched. The folks at Squid Labs left me alone with their laser etcher.
Aha. So this is directly into the aluminium of your MacBook. Looks great. So what kind of things do you make?
So I actually have always been into making things. You know, there's a section of the library, the 700s in the Dewey Decimal System, that's like how to make stuff. And that was like always my section where I'd go to in any library. And, you know, I worked as a kid, I was obsessed with building bikes and fixing them I just have always made things. And now I actually make something every week, something different. And then I make a video about how to make it and put it on the internet for people to see and know how to make stuff.
Which is a how-to video explaining from A to Z. We're probably leaving out a few letters.
Yeah, and then I try and fill in those details in a PDF that actually goes and gets downloaded in the podcast as well.
And that's what you do every week?
Every single week.
So you have 7 days from coming to the proper idea and eventually doing it and then producing a video on it. That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, it is. I didn't sleep for most Thursdays the first year.
Oh.
I would just...
Thursday is because it's being
it comes out on Friday.
Friday.
So everything, if it wasn't done, I would just keep going until it was done or Friday came.
This video podcast, we talked about this before, and you said that there are not so much how-to videos on the web and that you're probably only one of the few sources for that kind of information. Is that true?
Well, I would say I'm not. There's lots of people who do who are experts at one thing and make videos about it. So there's people who, you know, if there's people who are really good at making, you know, whatever kind of thing that they're good at making, and a lot of people will make videos about one or two things that they're experts on, but nobody else is making a video every week about how to make something. As far as I can tell.
Which is interesting. I mean, of course, they probably don't do it because it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I mean, you are in the good position that you actually get paid to do this, because this video podcast is part of the activities of Make Magazine.
Yep.
Still pretty fresh endeavor by O'Reilly.
Yep.
I think Make started around 2 or 3 years ago.
We just finished up our 12th magazine and we're quarterly, so we're 3 years right now.
3 years, right. So I'm not sure. It started, I think there was a blog from the start, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Then the magazine comes out every 3 months.
Yep.
And it really hit a nerve. That was my impression, that Make was really the right product at the right time, focusing on something that seems to be, it's not really new. It's just somebody had to come and start harvesting all the ideas and activities that were visible on the web. Mm-hmm. So people who are making things. And so I think the title is great, Make Magazine. I mean, it's just also has this super cool association with the Unix make command.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is always the one you call when you want to have things being done.
Yep.
Although you have to prepare the work still. And the computer is just finishing it. But that I found interesting. And the magazine itself is beautifully reprinted, lots of illustrations, and things really get explained. So that's good. So your video podcast, since when is this?
So I started doing videos. Well, it's interesting. I started doing videos in 2004. And then at the beginning of 2005, I was like, I'm going to be, because I was playing with all sorts of video stuff because it was kind of fresh. And there was a small community of people making videos on the internet. And it was really fun. And then I was like, I'm going to focus. I'm just going to make videos where I interview people who make things. And I did one, and Philip sent me a message saying, hey, can we put this on Make Magazine? This would be awesome. And I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. And then I was like, I'm doing more of these. This is going to be cool.
So you're doing it for 2 years now?
Yep.
Okay. So, yeah, as I said, this is a lot of work. I mean, I have been doing podcasts for, I don't know, 2 years now as well. And even if it's audio, it's a lot of work. But video always seems to me is just another dimension, because you really have to, you know, dress fine.
I have to shave every once in a while.
Shave every once in a while. While audio podcasting gives you the freedom to, you know, be as rotten as you want it. Just make sure your voice is clear.
Yes.
And sounds sexy. So I wonder, first... What is it what you're doing? Are you a video podcaster? Are you a video blogger? I know you're using both words on your homepage to describe what you're doing.
You know, I might even call myself instead a video producer. And then, because I think video podcaster is just that it's going off to, you know, it's a podcast and it's going to iPods. That's kind of what that implies. Or it's going through iTunes, which it does. It is a podcast. And then a video blog is like a video that's on a blog, which is also a podcast because you've got an RSS feed that you can run through Reader. But I mean, what I'm doing is really producing a video. I'm a video producer. I'm producing a video show. And, you know, it's done in HD and it's high quality enough that I've got, you know, the archives that if it wanted to go on TV or if I wanted to make some sort of film or something like that, I could do that. I'm not that interested in that, but it's just... Video is basically video, and I just happen to be producing it in the way that I think that it can get to the most people over the internet.
But you have the typical limited set of tools that you actually use to produce it. I've just taken a look at your nice little HD camera, which is a...
Yep.
What is it called?
It's an Exacti HD2.
Okay.
And I've got a little wide-angle lens, which makes it actually worth it. And
okay.
And basically, so... Would you like to hear about... I could tell you about my process.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to dive into. So how is your working
so
process?
Usually I kind of have an idea of what I want to do at the beginning of the week. I have a... when I first started out... Excuse me. When I first started out, I was just basically... Every week I'd be like, what am I going to do next? What's going to happen next? And I would just figure it out. And then I started making a list, and now I have a list with way too many things on it that it's a never ending list. It's growing faster than I can do them. And then a lot of things happen. Like I meet somebody and they're like, hey, have you heard about making this? Or somebody sends me an email. Hey, why don't you make one of these things? And I'm like, wow, that's actually a really good idea. I'm going to do that now. And then I'll go and get stuff and pull it all together and make it happen. So generally the way it works is I do some research for a day or two at the beginning of the week. And then I'm looking now. I'm watching Tim filming me as we're doing this.
Yeah, I'm just trying to be a podcaster, but I'm closely listening to what you say. Keep on.
And well, we can post up this video if you want to have the actual video of the space.
Yeah, it's probably the most annoying video ever made.
Metadata. Metadata. You can't have too much.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, so I usually come up with the idea and then I spend the weekend and usually Monday doing research and figuring out what kind of I need to know or how it works and if other people have done it, how they've done it. And then some point Tuesday or Wednesday and Thursday, I'm recording things and then Thursday night I'm uploading, I'm compressing and Friday I'm uploading and writing the PDF that goes along with it. And so it's basically all I do.
Yeah,
and I eat and I sleep sometimes.
And it's really the we do it all process. I mean, usually if you are in the TV business, you have a job and you just fill in one, you know, one little hole in the whole system. And so people write scripts, or people are doing the camera, or they are the audio guys, or they are doing the production, moderation, whatnot. But in this business, in this internet production, publishing, publication, I don't know how I should call it, podcasting business, everybody has to do everything himself. So that process of doing that video is also a very good demonstration of making things, don't you think so?
Yeah.
I can only encourage people to, you know,
well, the nice
publish this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing is it's anybody could actually be doing what I'm doing or do whatever they do. Anybody could make a video podcast about whatever they want. The trick is you have to want to do it. If you don't want to do it, you're not going to do it, because it actually, you'll have lots of obstacles and lots of frustration and lots of not being exactly the way you want it to be. And you have to have enough desire and passion to be willing to move through those challenges and frustrations. And yeah.
You said you have been making things all your life, but you've also been teaching things.
Yeah.
You've worked as a teacher before, right?
Yep. Well, I actually figured out recently like that I have two things that I do, and one is like I like to be creative, and the other one is I like to support other people's creativity. And so before doing the podcast, I was a school teacher, and actually for the first few months of the podcast, I was doing both, which meant that I really didn't sleep. And so before this, I was a school teacher. I taught art and writing, and I would always teach four periods of art, and then they'd throw me a curveball. So like I once taught math, and I once taught, and then for a long time I taught writing. And as well in that extra little spot. But it was the same kind of thing of my goal was to empower young people to have as many different possibilities and opportunities to express themselves and be creative as possible. And so the nice thing is that the arts really still haven't been regulated as much as other subjects in the States. And so I was able to basically do whatever I want. Mm-hmm. And as long as the kids were happy and the parents were happy.
You were not really tied to
nobody
any plan.
Bothered me, yeah.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yep.
I doubt any teacher can say that.
Well, I occasionally would get bothered. But for the most part, I had a lot of freedom to work with the kids. And
What age?
So for 5 years, I taught middle school, which is medium-sized children aged like 11 to 13.
Mm-hmm.
And then before that, for 2 years, I taught music, drama, and dance to elementary school kids, kindergarten through fifth grade. So like 5 to 10.
So confronting them both in a very creative part of the life.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty rewarding, isn't it?
There were, except for the money, it was really pretty great. I mean, the thing about teaching is that it's really, I mean, it's the most important job that I believe that there is in a society, in a community as a responsibility for inspiring young people to explore who they are. But also as a society, at least in the States, it's really clear that it's as a culture, as a government, as a society, it's the absolute lowest priority of our culture. You know, I had been teaching for 7 years and I was making $31,000. And
so it's basically underpaid and only rewarding because of the feedback of those you are teaching.
Yeah. And also, I mean, also with what's gone under George Bush, more and more restrictions and testing and criteria and structure and stuff.
Testing of what?
Like for 2 or 3 weeks in the year, kids get tested, and it's important that the kids do well on these tests every year in schools. And so it's actually taken a bunch of creativity out of teaching, in that teachers are now basically, they have to make sure that the kids can meet these certain criteria.
What kind of criteria is it? Like
it's number of
stars in the
mostly. It's
banner.
Like it's writing. It's because the test is kind of. It's actually not like. It's, I wouldn't say it's like a bad test. It's just that it's So it's like in Washington State, it's the WASL, the Washington Assessment of Student Learning. And it's just that it's, there's more and more teachers right these days are being asked to do more and more, like jump through more and more hoops, do more and more like of the really like boring, frustrating, just process oriented bureaucracy type work. And teaching's already takes all your time in the world. So then, don't get me started on education in America.
Okay. So you've been there, done that.
Yeah. It was great. I learned a lot. You know, being with 30 kids at a time in a classroom is something that everybody should have to do. And
yeah, okay.
Make that entertaining. Imagine. For everybody there and the learning experience. But the nice thing was is that I did get to be able to get the have students do meaningful creative work.
So and then you stopped being a teacher, but you also told me that you've been with the Muppets.
Not with the Muppets, but with Jim Henson's Creature Shop. Yeah.
Okay.
I had this kind of adventure when I finished college, and that I was a really naive young person, and luckily my uncle at the time, Donald Kushner, basically said, "Hey, you want to go? I hear you're into puppets. You want to go work on this movie?" And so I got a chance to go and make tea for some of the best people in the world working on movies. It started in Prague, working on
make
a film.
Make tea for them.
Yeah, that was... Well, I did all sorts of things, but it was a British crew, so I had the most important job.
Producing excellent quality tea.
Oh, they gave me such a hard time for the first 2 months.
Oh.
They're like, "We have an American here making us tea. This is hell."
Oh, my God. So you've been a puppeteer before, you said? So you've been...
So then after that...
One of the things you've made were puppets.
Yep. Then after that, worked for the Jim Henson's Creature Shop for a little while, and then I went back to Seattle and worked for Carter Family Marionettes and worked with Clay Martin, another puppeteer who's really awesome in Seattle, and made puppets and did workshops in schools. And that's what actually got me into teaching was I think I'd always wanted to be with young kids and work with them, but they'd scared me, and then... Turns out they weren't going to eat me alive, so I became a teacher.
What's the audience of what you do? I mean, do you have enough feedback that you can say anything about who is actually listening or watching your videos?
Well, it's I get equal kind of downloads from iTunes and YouTube and actually on the page. And the feedback that I get a lot of feedback actually from people who are doing home education, who are teaching their kids at home. A lot of them watch the podcasts and make the projects. It's really great. That makes me really happy. And then also, it depends on the video. Like I did a project which is all about foxhole radios, which is about radios that were made by GIs during World War II that are just made out of like a safety pin, a razor blade, a toilet paper tube, and some wire and some headphones. No batteries. And that video got battered around and was watched by all sorts of people who, you know, that brought back all sorts of memories for them. And that was, it depends on kind of the video. Sometimes the video actually gets its own audience because of the subject matter. But I would say, you know, I don't have a lot of information, but I'd say people who teach their kids at home. Lots of parents watch with their kids and do the projects.
So you're
it's a family
you're,
kind
so
of
you're
thing.
A teacher again.
Yep.
In a way.
It's a bigger classroom.
Mm-hmm. Mac Magazine is also doing, is it an annual fair, the Maker Fair?
We actually had two this year, and Maker Fair is really cool. It's a gathering of makers who come and basically are rock stars for a weekend. They come and they set up what they make, and the world... Like thousands of people in San Francisco, we had 40,000 people come, who come and see what they're doing.
40,000 people are coming to that fair.
Yeah,
it's big. It's really big, and it was like as many from the start, wasn't it?
I think it grew a little bit, but yeah.
But from the start, it was like I heard 30,000 something.
Yep. Well, I mean,
that's what I meant with. I think it hit a nerve. It really took up on a spot where people have already been. Yeah, they are doing things. They're using this new era of almost unlimited availability of components. I mean, that's the point. I mean, people have been doing things, but today there are so many things that are already ready to be integrated. There are tons of standards around which you can just plug things together that haven't been available before. I mean, the table here is filled with some stuff. What have you brought?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the brain machine.
So we've got the brain machine
it?
That you put this on and it shifts your brain. Your brain synchronizes with it to experience different brainwave states. The TV Begone. These are both Mitch Altman projects and both build on Lady Ada's work. This is actually a Lady Ada project. She built on Mitch's work. And then with the TV Begone, Mitch built on Lady Ada's work using the Mini POV 3. And then I've got a little, I've got a really great thing that I use with my iPhone. That's it's a USB battery charger or power source
in an Altoids tin box.
The ultimate project box, yeah.
I've seen the tons of projects that just use it as a container for whatnot. Yeah.
And then I've got a project here. What I've been doing this December is making projects that people can make and give as gifts. And this is a little tensegrity thing that. It's a little ornament that you could make. I really like this. My
rubber band and straws.
Yeah, but it looks really cool.
Yeah, it's great. Isn't it one of these Buckminster Fuller?
Yeah, and
what
it's
called.
My dad actually. I was born in Carbondale, and my dad was studying doing graduate work with Buckminster Fuller when I was born.
So now we would need video, but we don't have it. We have to.
We'll link
use
to a picture.
Audio and try to be. As good as we can in our descriptions. So,
or you can go see the video. The video will be up at makezine.com/podcast, or you can look at my Flickr feed at flickr.com/photo/brie.
All the links you need of all the things we mentioned here are in our show notes on the website.
Which I have to say are awesome. You have some of the best show notes out there because you list all the links and you don't go on and on about them. You just do the link. And it sends you there.
Right. Like that. That's why it takes so long for me to produce my podcast because I'm always listening to them once more, which can be very time consuming. But that's the quality I want to provide here. So that brings me back to the Congress and the talk
you
are going to do. It's called DIY, Do It Yourself Survival.
Yeah.
So I guess it's going to be about making things. What is it going to be about in particular?
Well, it started because I was actually on the subway in New York City waiting for a train, and there was this gentleman singing street musician singing songs, and he was like singing these love songs, and they were just like everybody like was affected. It was beautiful. And some guy shuffles past me with a grimace on his face looking miserable, and he just basically he kind of mutters to me as he passes by, you know, it just gives you a shred of hope for the future of humanity, doesn't it? And it was just like, whoa, this person really has no hope. There's, you know, this person really thinks humanity's over for the most part, unless we can sing love songs, I guess, all the time. But I started just noticing how many people like feel that the end of the world is inevitable within our lifetimes. And I just thought, you know, well, there's a few things. Well, one, if it's going to happen, I'd like to enjoy it up to the last minute. I'm not going to be miserable about it. And two, if it's going to happen, I feel like I should be prepared. So so I'm basically putting together a presentation of things that you can make and do to be prepared for multiple different types of disaster situations. And some of them are practical and some of them are preposterous, but for
disaster situations.
I'm from in Seattle, we have multiple disasters possible. We have like there's a volcano that's active nearby that could happen, and a giant 100-foot wave of mud, boiling hot, could sweep over the city. Mm-hmm. There's tsunamis because it's next to the ocean and the Pacific, and the whole place could be wiped out.
Is there a real probability that this volcano is going up?
Well, sometime in the next like 10,000 years.
10,000 years. Okay, so Microsoft.
But you never know.
Safe. Yeah.
And and then there's also things like Boeing and Microsoft, which you know, back in the day, during the Cold War, we all thought, well, we're a target for that. But so, yeah. Oh, and then we have earthquakes. I've been in one earthquake in Seattle that was pretty serious, and then, but that's not nearly as serious.
How does it feel?
Well, I was in my classroom and we got up to go, and everything started. It was kind of like being on like a truck when it's moving, and everything started going back and forth, and there was a moment, maybe 5 seconds, where everybody was just stunned. And then some kid yelled out, "It's an earthquake." And I basically yelled, "Get under the desks now." And I've never had an instruction followed so instantly. And everybody dived under desks. And the trick is you want to hold on to the desk as well, because the desk is moving back and forth. And it, you know, everything is kind of lurching, but it's not like it's lurching in a regular pattern. It's sometimes it lurches more. And yeah.
So it was already a pretty serious earthquake in a way.
It lasted maybe 10 seconds, and then we just basically held it down for a while, and there weren't, usually there are like, sometimes there are like aftershocks, but at this one there wasn't.
Duck and cover. So that brings me to, DIY survival.
I'm going to be talking about ham radio and APRS and how to filter water and stuff like that.
Ah, okay. So things you could make to actually survive any kind of disaster.
And
like internet outages.
I know. That's going to be the one that hits us the hardest, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be like, come on, where's Twitter?
My feet are gone. I can feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
IM isn't working.
My mind is gone.
I mean, it's interesting, but I don't know, for some people, if you're not attached to the internet like I am, it may not affect you, but I rely on the internet for most of my personal communications right now. So
you have a lot of experience with doing things. You have a lot of experience with teaching things. You have a lot of experience with actually demonstrating how to do things. What would you suggest for people who think about doing projects that address other people, younger people, or whoever, how to actually motivate them into doing things? Because my experience is, from myself, I'm a very bad maker. I have troubles with hardware. Yeah, I'm a software guy, I have to confess. I love the, you know, being completely in a digital world where it's like easy to push bits around. But the real world with all these wires and power and stuff took a while for me to, you know, get acquainted with everything. So can you provide guidelines or tips at least on how to address these groups? If somebody would like, we have a hackerspace and I want to do some kind of open workshop addressing new people, we have something like this going. Mm-hmm. You've probably have talked about this at the Chaos Computer Club in Cologne. They have this U23 project, which addresses like people under 23. And they're also doing hardware really cool stuff.
To explain a little bit about that, basically they have people come in and there's mentors, and basically there's small teams of young people, and they're issued a challenge. And every other year, it's a hardware challenge, and then it flip-flops with a software challenge. Mm-hmm. And usually it's something interesting, like making a IM client that can, through encryption, be completely anonymous. So kids can use IM at school and not have to worry about being tracked, you know, stuff like this. So, and then it's interesting though, because it's not just about making things there. It's also about, they have to learn how to use teamwork and work in a team and figure out how to and problem solve. And so I think your question is how to address people to get who are interested in making things, but are at some sort of a block.
And also to make them interested in things, because that's why I mentioned my experience. Sometimes people are just scared because they think it's too complicated, too much work. I don't know, things they don't understand, or I don't know, too dangerous, whatnot. So what's your approach?
Well, I mean, I think it's different for everybody. I mean, I feel similarly actually about hardware that you feel, or software that you feel about hardware.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of the things that I do, I don't know how to do. And a lot of times I'll start on things. And some of my more ambitious projects, I've actually had to bring other, I've had to get lots of help. Because, you know, it's, there's just things that I don't, I'm not, it, that would take me a long time to learn how to do. So I'm thinking like with the drawing robot that I made, and with the near space balloon that some I actually didn't make. These are all collaborative projects where I started them and then desperately needed help. And so I would say that making things is really rewarding. And one of the things you need to want to do is you have to want to make them. You have to want to make something. So if there's nothing you want to make, then there's not much you can do to make somebody make something. But if you get, if you are around people who are making things, that's usually pretty inspiring. So I think it kind of, so I think there's a number of different kind of like elements that are in place to get somebody making things or feeling like a maker, I think is what you're saying, what you're asking how to get to. And one is basically wanting something to make and having an interest in making something. And that's one of the places where the magazine is really good, because it's really lots of pictures and lots of things that to inspire you. And you don't even have to know how to make it sometimes. You can you don't even have to make it sometimes. You can just want to make it or know how to make it, and that can be enough to inspire other ideas. So if you're interested in electronics, the nice thing is that you can get kits nowadays. You don't have to, you know, make your own PCB boards. You can go to, we've actually got a bunch of kits at the Make store that you can, we've got the TV Be Gone kit and mini POV kits, persistence of vision kits, and all sorts of stuff that you can go
kits
there.
Kits for building completed, well,
little
complete
projects.
Projects.
Yeah. And the kind of things
but
where...
Also, the I thought you were talking about platforms for developing on... Which was the one you were recently using, this... forgot the name. This electronic board that you can program?
Arduino.
All right.
Yeah. Arduino is huge right now, actually. If you're interested... You know, and that is one of the things that's really cool. If you're a software guy and you want to get into making things, microcontrollers is a really good place to start, because... the language is pretty straightforward in terms of the programming language, and it's not rocket science to be able to get things to blink and move around and sensors and things. And so you can start physically programming for physical computing. So you can start making software actually do things. And with I've seen friends who are software people get into physical, like hardware programming for hardware, and yeah, that's when nobody sleeps, because it gets really exciting and you make tweaks and you can see it instantly in the physical object what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a good place to start if you're into software.
Yeah, microcontrollers are becoming a really interesting topic, especially for the art scene.
Yeah,
which is sort of in a transition from my point of view. Art has been mainly in a very how can I put it? It's, you know, if somebody has been producing art in the last 20 years, it was mainly either installation, picture, you know, something very simple. And when technology was involved, usually they had, you know, their guy coming in and finishing off some tasks. But some of the most brilliant things I've seen that involve electronics are usually from people who actually are from that domain, who have really knowledge about computers. Not necessarily huge hackers that know everything, you know, they're not the ultimate geeks. It's just that they have acquainted themselves with technology enough to really understand what it's doing in order to do these usually very simple things that make their installations work. So... but there's a change now, and you can also see if you're following the Make blog or other outlets like Boing Boing and Gadget, all these huge blogs that also tend to cover the stuff. You've already mentioned that GRL in Vienna, the what's the abbreviation? The Graffiti Research Lab, which have been... totally stunned me with their idea, which was so simple, like the laser controlled
graffiti.
graffiti done by a projector. So it's nothing but a projector. So the best thing of this is the idea.
Yeah.
But then it's well done in terms of delivery, and you can really tell from the beginning that these people have understood technology far enough to adapt the proper technology to it. They're not totally overdoing it. I've seen so many art installations that are just, you know, doing something really simple, like having a loudspeaker go on and off. In order to do this, they have a full PC with, you know, scripted web browsers that hit web pages, and it's so overdoing it because they don't really know what to do. Although they could also take one of these small microcontroller boards, have 10 or 20 lines of code doing the same thing, which would be, of course, much more elegant and cheaper as well.
The other thing that you bring up with the GRL, or that comes up with the GRL folks, is that they're sharing what they're doing. So not only are they doing insanely cool stuff, but they're saying, hey, if you want to do this too, here, do it. Here's what you need. Make it happen. Let us know. We'd love to hear about it. And I mean, that's the cool thing about making right now, is because of the internet, there's all these people, maybe only 1% of the people who make something are actually posting a picture or doing some narrative about it on the internet. But it's enough that it's like, if you want to do something, there's probably somebody who's done something similar, and you can figure out how and they're probably, you can reach them and ask them how they did it over email and have access to people like we've never had before who are doing things. And like you said earlier, with the access to like components and microcontrollers, it's probably the most exciting time ever in terms of making things.
That's true. The culture of sharing is probably one of the other driving factors here. And the software scene has been doing this for a long time, and we've all seen what's coming out of this, complete operating systems, applications, and so on. And here and there, it's also coming into this, I don't really know how to call this, an art scene, it's not. I would say it's a maker scene.
Yeah.
And one of the, also again talking about the traditional art scene, something they haven't really understood, in my point of view, is the concept of sharing. Yeah, they're really behind, you know, keeping their ideas for themselves, not telling about details, not publishing any kind of source code, because they don't really know that source code is involved in realizing their project, probably. And of course, have no idea of the methods of sharing as well. Mm-hmm. While groups like GRL, and we've been doing something similar with our Blinken Lights project, we had, you know, we had the knowledge on how to do this, and we had the experience of sharing. So we just shared the stuff. So the code, everything. And the interesting effect is that people are actually taking up on the work. They take it and they refine it, and they do some kind of interpretation, extending it, bug fixing it maybe. And that's a very interesting experience, that your stuff lives on, probably not forever, but definitely longer than you would originally expect it.
And if you haven't done this, you can't underestimate the feeling that you get when you make something and you publish it to the internet and somebody else makes it and they do it differently in some way, or they make a change. It's like, it's actually, you know, it's a great feeling to make something in that sense of accomplishment. It's actually, for me, it's a step up from that, in the, like, it's just because you know that somebody actually was interested in enough that they wanted to kind of do what you did, and they cared enough to make it personal to them and make some sort of, make a change.
I think what people need to get is a new way about thinking about the concept of copying, because generally, especially in the art scene, again, copying is considered to be a bad thing.
Yeah.
Oh, he copied my idea, my concept, my project, whatever. Like the music industry in a way. Yeah. But on the other hand, the best stuff is always what is being copied. So we should just, you know, encourage copying in a way.
And
to a certain extent, I mean, needs to be.
Well, I mean, if you add in attribution, you solve most of the problems.
Yeah, right.
Because if let's say one of the things I try and do is, I try and, if I, when I'm doing research on this stuff and I'm getting inspiration from people, I always try and send them links and say, hey, I was inspired by these projects and these people, because I want them to get credit as people who've done it and people who've gone before me in some way or another. And in some cases, people have done that with me, where they've gone and taken something to a higher level and they've said, oh yeah, this person out there did this podcast that, you know, was interesting enough to make me do it. And I just think that it's really, yeah, like the art scene, I think it can learn from this. And I think, oh, it's just, I just think it's the most exciting thing when people share stuff and other people do it. I think it's really hard though to imagine though, because we're such a culture of like, this is mine, ownership, that the idea of sort of, it's a feeling like, oh, I'm letting it go, somebody else is going to steal it from me. But it's actually, that's not the reality of the situation. The reality of something is you're letting it go. And it's like letting your kid go off to college so they can learn more, you know?
Yeah, letting go is always good, especially with things you are in love with.
Yes. Yes.
So maybe getting back to this how to do it thing. And I was looking for some kind of, you know, guidelines.
Okay, I got some. Or
if you have some more, share.
Well, so just to wrap it up. So basically, if you want to get into it, find something you actually care about and you want to do. Don't be worried if it's something really difficult. Like my friend Zach, who's in NYC Resistor, Zach Hoken, he is a programmer, and he heard about self-replicating robots, the RepRap project. And he basically he saw this and something in him and clicked, and he said, I'm going to devote all my free time to making self-replicating robots. And even though he's never touched hardware, 1 year later, he's creating boards in Eagle, sending them off to China. He started a foundation, a nonprofit, so that he could, whatever he learned, he could buy tons of them and then sell them for just like cost plus 10% to cover some stuff. And he's doing all the programming. He's switching it over to Arduino so that it's entirely open source. And he did all this without knowing how to do it beforehand a year ago. And so, no, wanting to do it is actually the most important thing. And then most everything else falls in place. The next thing, of course, is do research and find out who else is doing it. And if there's not a community in place, find a way of starting it. You know, if there's three people who are doing the thing that you're interested in the world, start an email thread where you're emailing all three of them. And then if possible, actually meet with other people who are involved with it. And because it's always more fun and more rewarding to do things with other people and be in a group. That's what's so exciting about, for me, about the whole hacker group, that the hacker space thing going on that started with Chaos Computer Club, that I'm so excited about, you know, bringing to New York, is that I can't wait to personally go to this place and spend entire weeks staying up really late drinking Club Mate, working on insanely cool projects that I feel proud of and feel a sense of community around.
How are you going to bring Club Mate to New York?
You know, this is actually one of the main problems facing our club right now. Because actually every club we visited so far has basically said that like half of their rent comes from the sales of Club Mate.
That's true.
And it's so good. If you haven't had Club Mate, it's a drink that has mate in it, and it's fizzy, it's bubbly, and it's
basically lemonade, but it has slightly less sugar than other
like, and more caffeine,
and slightly more caffeine, and it works well. Yeah,
and it's refreshend und active. What does that mean? Is that the you get used to it?
Refreshing and active. Yeah, there are other nice descriptions on it somewhere else. I forgot it. But the best the best is the official tagline of that product is you get used to it.
I mean, I remember the moment I was at camp and I was like, we had some infrastructure at camp that was really functional. And on day two, we went out and we bought like 20 cases of Club Mate.
Oh, where did you get that from?
And I tasted it and I was like, this tastes like hay, like straw. And then I tasted it again and I just remember thinking, and I like it.
Yeah, you get used to it.
Yep, It's very
another
good.
Way of putting it, you are going to be addicted.
We actually had a taste test in New York. We got, there's 14 types of mate that you can buy in New York, and we bought all 14, and none of them match up to Club Mate, unfortunately. Even Macava, which is another
type. You could try, you know, replicating.
We need to reverse engineer it, honestly.
That would be a project.
Well, you know, I've actually got some connections where we've got one of these groups that makes mate, and I think I need to bring some bottles back with me and just basically say, make this for my hacker group or you'll... And I won't threaten them, but I will encourage them for the market of Club Mate.
Yeah, that would be a market, definitely. So, this NYC Resistor group, who has joined you there? What is this space going to be like once it's established?
Well, it's really nice because all sorts of different... We've got lots of different people involved who are from different backgrounds. I'll go through the ones that I can remember now. If I forget anybody, I'll have to owe them drinks.
We'll have to do this
drinks. Again. Yes. So we've got Nick Bilton, who's in R&D at the New York Times. He basically is one of the people in charge of figuring out what newspapers are going to look like in the future. And we've got, it originally started with George and Peter. George is a hacker in New York City who's very young and 20. And he is also the most ambitious of any of us. He's the one who, when we suggested getting, you know, looking for a space, he's the one who said, well, let's just buy a building. And when confronted with the fact that it could cost more than $1 million, said, well, we'll rent out the rest of it and make it a profitable business. And I just really love having George in because whenever there's a problem, he just suggests the best answer ever.
That's with good.
And he believes it's, and it's true, you know? So, and he's the person on the front page of NYC Resistor that has, he has Resistor on his, hands in fake tattoos. That's really,
okay.
And the big, he has
so
big
he's
hair.
Already living it.
Yes.
Okay.
And, there's, who else do we have? We've also got, we've got, let me look here so I can get everybody.
I just took a look at the blog of the NYC Resistor and I saw you posted the 23C3 documentation video.
Yes.
That's good. Do you like it?
Oh yeah, it's if you haven't seen this video, you can go to nycresistor.com and watch it because it's a really awesome video and it's basically going to make you wish you were here. So let's see. So other people involved are... Tom Igo is on our list of people, even though he's usually too busy to come to the meetings. He's running the physical computing program at NYU. And we've got Eric Bug, who's a musician and tinkerer. We've got more people than this. This is an old list here. We need to update our list. We've also got the person in charge of To This, TEUTHIS. Raphael is the person who came up with the... open source MP3 player, the Daisy, which is a MP3 player that you can make yourself and stick an SD card in it and play whatever songs you want in whatever format you want. And you can put it in anything you like. And we've got, we've also got a really awesome woman who is in charge of R&D at Victoria's Secret. She was on a project, she is on Project Runway and it does really innovative stuff with fabric.
Victoria Secret, was it?
R&D. It's like every guy's dream job, I think. Let me find her. Where is she? And so she's totally awesome. And she's really, she has a purse. And every 10 steps that she takes, it takes a picture and uploads it straight to Flickr. So she actually has... 100% all that she's documenting every 10 steps of her life.
Every 10 seconds.
Every 10 steps. It's
every
actually 10
steps.
I think it's GPS noting certain distance.
Steps, footsteps. Okay.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like this cat that is having.
Yeah.
You heard about the cat with
yep.
the camera on his neck.
And basically, you know, we've just got a group of people who are really, most of them are hardware based. And except for George, he's completely obsessed with servers and he's already gotten a...
That's good. You always need at least one admin.
Yes. And he's... What is it called? The open source PBX?
Asterisk.
He installed Asterisk in one day and has started been playing with this. And it's...
Yeah, it's an interesting part of this hackerspace idea, not only to have the physical space, but also the all these virtual spaces and the communication infrastructure that that you need. So you went for, of course, blog, and you have a mailing list.
Yep.
Anything else?
I can go on and on about the people, but yeah, there's also a whole group of people who come to meetings and just bring insanely cool stuff out of the woodwork from... We don't know how they find out about us, but they just bring really cool projects. And
this reminds me of the early days.
Yeah.
The Homebrew Computer Club, which is probably the first club of people who are interested in computers at all, which happened to, well, be in the 70s, which sort of the club where all those early wizards from Steve Wozniak, from who did the Apple, and all the other engineers have been around. And one or 2 years ago, I met Lee Felsenstein, who was the moderator of this group, and he talked a bit about those times where it was just more of a formal meeting where everybody joined the table and they had a talking stick-like way of presenting their projects.
Yep.
Which is a bit different to what we do in our hackerspaces, and probably not the approach of the 21st century, but it was interesting to see that they already had this urge to share their knowledge on their projects, although they're all more or less doing things that could bring in money, but they were sharing it in that club. So, but since then, I haven't really seen much of this culture in the US. Mm-hmm. So it seems like hacker spaces like the one you're describing are a new thing that is currently lacking.
I think it's coming up, though. There's also a group in Philly called The Hactory. I think they're thehactory.org. And they're just getting started. They've been doing Arduino classes, and they put it out there, and the classes fill up like in one day. So they're doing really cool stuff. And there's also a group in San Francisco that Mitch Altman and Jake Applebaum and friends are putting together. And I think there's rumors that they may have found a very central location already, but I cannot confirm that. But
what's the name of that project?
I don't know what the name is, actually.
I heard one, just forgot it.
I know it's just the San Francisco hackerspace, but
good.
We should.
There's going to be a cool name attached to it, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Excellent.
Jack Applebaum was also on this program already, and he did a talk 2 years ago.
Oh, cool.
At the Congress, and sort of he's one of those who started this renewed relationship between American and European hackers that we see now, which really comes to fruition with all these interchange between hacker spaces and sharing of ideas, which is very good to see it finally happening. We've been ignored for a very long time, I must admit.
You know, the thing is, though,
we're doing this for 24 years now.
There's also another space that I should mention, that because they're the ones who actually inspired me to know about the CCC, and that's the HackerBot Labs folks, Pablos and Eric and Divide and Adam, and there's about 20 people who get together every Saturday night in South Seattle in a warehouse district in a warehouse and hack on things and make insanely cool projects happen. And they were the ones that I was sitting down on a couch with, and they said, you should go to CCC, the camp. And then they were like, you should just do Hackers on a Plane. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then they were like, you realize you just PayPal'd $1,337 to the Hacker Foundation. And I was like, oh. They're like, it's all right, we know them. But so I think in the States, I know with NYC Resistor, the Hactory, HackerBot Labs, the San Francisco,
whatever the name is,
mystery name thing. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing. And there's another one, Machine Project, in LA, which I just learned about. which is they're doing Toddbot is doing an amazing Arduino workshop that he's totally documented and put all his PDFs online. So I'm not exactly sure what it is. All I know is that it's insanely cool, and I'm going to basically have to schedule a trip to LA this year to go there. So,
This reminds me that I did an interview with Pablos mm-hmm. as well. We've also been talking about this hands-on hacking, and we've been talking also about the American hacker culture, especially regards to conferences. So he's involved in ShmooCon, and
he's a really good speaker. If you ever get a chance to see him, you should.
As well, right? Have you been to one of these ShmooCon conferences?
I did. I went to ShmooCon this last year. I didn't get to see enough of it because I was a vendor there, and I was like selling subscriptions to make, and I was one of those people outside at a table instead of one of the people inside listening to everything. So I only heard a couple speakers speak, but it was a really good time. It's a Washington DC conference.
Mm-hmm. So talking about hackers and the feeling of sending $1,300 to the Hacker Foundation. Brings me to a recurring topic here. What's your take on the term hacker? What's your association with it, and how do you see the general public is talking about it?
I think... So basically, you have people who understand it and people who don't. And the people who don't understand it generally think that hacking is something that people do that's illegal, that is like spying, or that's something like, oh, my computer got hacked and all my files and personal life has been stolen. But that's just like, that's not what it's about. Hacking is about being a hacker, is being able to, you know, especially with technology where so often we're faced with like a beige box or, you know, an iPod where you can't get into it. The true hacker mindset is somebody who just wants to understand how something works and use it however in the way that they want to use it. Not necessarily the way that they've been told to use it, but they want to learn enough about it that they understand it. And I mean, once you understand that, you just get it and you see it. And once you meet people who do this, you start realizing that there's hackers everywhere. Most mechanics are hackers in some way or another, because who knows, some weird car might drive up and they've got to figure out how to fix it in one way or another using the resources they have at hand. Most software engineers who may not even call themselves hackers are usually hackers, because usually they're given some kind of code and they have to do something with it, and they have to make it work. They have to learn how it works and make it work for them. So, with hardware, the way most hardware hackers work is basically they're interested in figuring out how hardware works and then being able to use it and use it as potential, you know, instead of being something that's just like something that is you're given and you're told how to use it. They want to learn all the different ways that it's possible to use it.
And well, in Europe, well, I totally share this view, of course, but in Europe, we also have this very strong political part in mm-hmm. in the hacking scene. So it's not only about technology, it's also about how can you apply, what happens if you apply certain technology to society, you know, are rules in place that, you know, deal with it in the same manner. Is that something you can see in the US as well?
You know, this is when I was on the Hackers on a Plane tour, I was hanging out a lot with Dan Kaminsky, and we had this light bulb moment where we were thinking about the way that, you know, because here in Europe, hackers are generally thought of as, you know, the last bastion of human rights in Europe. And in some way, they're thought like, okay, if everything goes to hell, hackers will be able to somehow make
CCC
it right.
CCC is going to yes. save us.
And so, you know, and you've got it's such a great
Robin
history
Hood
of,
image,
yeah. yeah, of, you know, I've heard the stories of how, you know, when the BTX machines came out, you had it donate to the, you hacked it so that it would donate to the CCC, and then you brought it all back to them and said, hey, we've set it up so that, you know, you would donate 10, however many thousand euros or Deutschmarks, and here it is all back. I think you have a security problem.
Right, before they even knew.
Yes. Oh, it's so great. And so, I mean, you've got such a great, there's just an ethic there from the beginning of, hey, we're going to learn how things work and make sure that things are done right. And that vulnerabilities are exposed, not to like, you know, hold over somebody's head, but to make sure that things are fair. And so in the States, we don't quite have that. We don't have that history, even though there are definitely lots of people who do that kind of work in the States. It's not so much embodied. So I think one of the things that's going to be interesting is sometime in the next 5 years, we're going to have, you know, we've got 5 or 6 different hackerspaces growing right now that are in baby stage. And sometime in the next 5 years, there's going to be, dang, maybe we could do it next year. We could just get some sort of like some, you know, American Congress of some sort together to basically say, hey, let's take the unifications we've got with our clubs and local regional areas and do some cross. I'm not sure what could happen, but I'm pretty confident that something interesting will happen.
Good. Interesting that you're talking about hacker ethic. Well, you know, the hacker ethic that's always been talked about is actually an excerpt from a book by Stephen Levy. I had the opportunity to interview Stephen Levy also on this podcast recently. Well, not so recently, but last year. But I finally had the opportunity, which was cool, because I could ask him about like how he sees things going with this hacker ethic that he was describing, which was just a description of what he saw. It was just like his impression, not really a rule set. But one of these so-called rules or ethic statements, I don't know how to call it, was the always yield to the hands-on imperative.
Yes.
Which I always found very encouraging in a way it's expressed. Do you share this?
You know, this was something that was that every hackerspace has said, and usually it's said like the person who does it is always right, or he who's involved gets, you know, right of way.
That's one of the golden rules in the CCC as well. Whoever is like taking action, he is right.
Yeah.
Just because he's taking action.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So so I think that, yeah, there you go. What was the question? Where were we going with that?
I just wanted to, you know, this always yield to the hands-on imperative. It's such a complicated phrase in a way. Not everybody is really understanding, but basically it means like make way. Here are the ones who are actually doing it. Yeah, they are just testing it for themselves. They make sure they've seen it with their own eyes, and other associations that come up when I think about it. I like this hands-on approach, and I think that hackerspaces, and also what you are doing with your video podcast, is sort of speaking that language. Yeah, get to the things, try it for yourself, think for yourself, and do it yourself. It's good for your survival, maybe.
And I mean, the other thing is that I think is really important is be honest about your mistakes. One of my favorite things that I'm really proud of with my podcast is like when I try some way of doing something and it doesn't work, I do my best to show like, this didn't work. So
I tried it, but it didn't work.
So like when I tried winding up wire on toilet paper tube by sticking the toilet paper tube onto a drill press and then turning it on, complete chaos ensued. It didn't work, but to me it was important that like people know that it doesn't always work. In fact, it never works the first time when you do anything.
And documenting it is also very interesting, because sometimes failure is telling much more about how to do things than success.
And my hope is that somebody sees it and goes, oh, it's not all going to be, you know, because so often people start down paths following a really brilliant passion, but they hit an obstacle and they stop. And that's just part of the process, is that you're going to hit obstacles. And I hope that people don't stop and they keep doing, because that's how exciting things happen. And I want to hear about more of them.
Okay. So thanks, Bree, for this long interview and interesting talk on how to make things. I hope I will find the time to join your talk at the Congress.
Excellent.
And all the links to your podcast and everything, your homepage, in the show notes of this podcast. And I hope it's not going to be the last one for months, but I try to produce more of Chaos Radio Express. If you know how to listen to German language, then the Chaos Radio Express podcast is for you. We are doing much more work here in German than on English, but that's just how things are.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks again, and thank you for listening to this episode of this podcast. And we say goodbye.
Thank you.